This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we discover how to gather and use the wild yeast that's all around us here on the Central Coast.
Here I am in my kitchen attempting to make bread with this yeast that we found next to the poison oak plant.
Also, we'll learn about a nonprofit called Lighthouse Atascadero.
I think that the important thing is that we all understand, we being all of us in our community, that addiction is a very, very serious thing.
Those stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, May 18th, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. It's now been over 2 months that San Luis Obispo County, the state, and indeed most of the country has been under a stay-at-home mandate. The county's order expired Saturday, and it was not renewed because, say county health officials, we're still under the state order. But San Luis Obispo County is trying to move faster in the reopening process than the state. In order to do so, it will need to demonstrate to state health officials a capacity to handle any resurgence of the COVID-19 cases and other public health metrics. First up, we hear from a medical professional who is a key player in the local reopening plan.
My name is Trace Ritter. I'm a specialist in infectious diseases. I am also the chief medical officer for the Arroyo branch of Marion Regional Medical Center. I'm trained in infectious diseases and internal medicine. And this is an experience which I've described to friends and colleagues as one that you're trained to do but never hope to do in your entire life. So here we are. We're doing our best. And I'm very proud of the community that I live in and the excellent work that I've being seen, that I've seen done out there by our community members. And we're getting to the point where I've actually heard, you know, people complaining. And one of the things I hear them say is, well, you know, none of my friends have this. Why are we doing all this? And, you know, I must admit that we are a victim of our own success at this point. So I'm going to take a minute or two and help remind everybody why we're doing this and how we got here. So what we're facing is a global pandemic. And very infrequently does something come along that has a pandemic potential. And this virus, this SARS-CoV-2 virus, and the disease it's called being COVID-19 is unique in its ability to cause a global pandemic, in that it is relatively easy to spread between people to people. It is a novel virus, meaning nobody on Earth has any immunity to this. And we don't really have therapy for it. It is also in that sweet spot of disease that it causes, where it's not going to kill everybody and interrupt the cycle of transmission, but it is infective enough and dangerous enough that it could have a significant impact on a population of people without any immunity. So what we know is that roughly 80% of people that will get this will have a relatively mild illness and not require any type of health care. About 20%, however, will need a hospitalization, and maybe a third to a half of those might even require the intensive care unit, including a ventilator. And if you just take very conservative estimates of let's say half of SLO County gets this over 3 or 4 months, that's being very, very conservative. And let's say only 1% of the people that get this need a ventilator. That's still 1,400 people that would likely require a ventilator. And I'll just remind you that our current SLO County capacity, for including the surge, is less than 100 intensive care unit beds. So clearly we're an order of magnitude different. And that's the problems that we're trying to prevent by sort of hitting the pause button and allowing our community to get more ramped up with as far as testing, contact tracing, and our ability to care for this novel virus and the people that it's affecting. So we have at the current time seen about 227 cases and one death in SLO County. And we again are a bit of a victim of our own success. And we had time on our side before this because of our geographic isolation. It arrived into our community a bit later. And so we were really able to tamp down the numbers. And we've gotten to a low point with our numbers where with reopening, it is likely that the numbers will only go one direction. And so we have to be ready for that. That's what we're doing. And so that's why the mitigating features as we move forward to opening up our economy, which I agree is of the utmost importance at this point, we just need to do it in a safe manner. And that was one of the goals of the START document, which I was one of the authors on. There was several of us from the medical community that were involved with that, including my colleague, Dr. Kevin Ferguson, who is sort of become our testing guru in the private arena for our two counties. And we actually did this de novo before the state released their guidance. And it's surprising not to pat ourselves on the back, but what a good job we did in anticipating what some of the things were that they would be looking at to make this something that the whole state could deal with. And so the state resiliency roadmap, you can all find that online. It's divided up into four stages. We've now left stage one into stage two, and there is a process by which you can get local variants, and I believe that 17 or 19 rural counties have successfully gone through that. What we've been trying to do is talk more about testing trends rather than absolute numbers with tests. And so those our testing trends have been consistent. So some of the other things that we're looking at, and probably what you wanted me to speak to, is really the feedback loop from the healthcare environment, which really is the reason that this was all done, because we didn't want to have to ration healthcare. That's something that people, I believe, in our country just don't have the stomach to do. And we don't want to be put in that position where we've got to decide that, that somebody gets a ventilator and somebody does not get a ventilator. And those were, unfortunately, some of the decisions that had to be made in some of the more hard-hit areas of the country, specifically in northern Italy. These were decisions that groups were having to make. And so some of the features that we will be feeding back from the healthcare environment to the county as far as whether or not we can continue to move progressively through the stages, or whether we might need to pause, or in a worst case scenario, take a step back, which nobody wants to do. So that's the ability and capacity of our hospitals to care for these sick patients. So ICU capacity, and we settled on a ability to surge our ICU capacity by at least 30%, and the state document came up with 35%. So we thought we were pretty close on that. The ability to screen large numbers of patients in our hospital environment, as well as sufficient personal protective equipment, or PPE, in our hospitals, which is something that all hospitals were struggling with, to the point where we needed to put practices into place to conserve PPE rather than, throwing away a disposable mask. We were asking people to conserve it where they could stay safe, with the ultimate goal was protecting our healthcare workers, because that's one of our vital resources. Sufficient masks, and then some of the amount of patients coming into the hospital with COVID versus discharged with COVID. And we really want to have that be somewhat subjective. And that's why we're looking more at trends rather than absolute numbers, because you can really paint yourself into a corner, especially when you're dealing with numbers of hospitalized patients or even tested patients, where it might be related to a specific exposure or into a family group. I mean, one family could get this and you can get six new positive cases within a day or two. So those are some of the things that we're looking at doing feedback with. And then we also have the public health and epidemiology categories in these tables that are available in the START guide.
That was Dr. J. Trace Ritter, a local infectious disease specialist involved with San Luis Obispo County's reopening plan, speaking during a webinar hosted by the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. A recording of the full hour-long May 14th discussion is available on the Chamber's website. During the same webinar, SLO County Supervisor Lynn Compton provided a rundown on why the county decided to start aligning itself with the state's reopening plan and the current status of the county's plan, called the START Guide. Here's Compton.
So the START Guide was sort of born out of the fact that we're a pretty rural county here, and population under 300,000. When the whole COVID situation broke, we were trying to get resources from the state, and we found the priority areas were Los Angeles and San Francisco, where they had had the big outbreaks. So for things like ventilators, for medical personnel, different things like that, we were reaching out to the state, and we got the impression we were pretty much on our own. So we felt we wanted to protect our residents and take care of them. So we needed to kick it into gear and really fend for ourselves to get through this. That was kind of the impetus for starting up the alternate care site in conjunction with Cal Poly and different individuals, private enterprise, and getting that all into place, just knowing we had to take care of ourselves. So looking down the road in eventually opening back up again, really there wasn't any plan coming out of Sacramento, and the governor had made several statements saying localism is determinative, etc. So I think we felt like we had to kick into the gear and put a plan in place to demonstrate at certain points we would be ready to open different segments of our businesses. So I think that's kind of how the START Guide was born. It was an effort by a lot of different people in this community in different segments of business, for example, agriculture, manufacturing, technology, et cetera. And there were different teams put together with different individuals from those different segments of the economy. The START Guide really, though, was controlled by our medical personnel, and there were epidemiologists and physicians and Dr. Penny Bornstein. It was not a political process. We really didn't have any say in it for the most part. There were four individuals that were elected individuals that were put on a team to evaluate it as we went through, and those elected individuals participated in two meetings, and that's it. So it was really based on medicine and moving forward in a safe manner. There were different criteria for different businesses. For example, if you were in the hospitality industry, what does the hospitality industry need to do to make their industry safe as they move forward? So that's kind of how the whole process was born. And as we move forward, we initiated our shelter in place. The governor then the next day initiated his shelter in place. We moved forward. We did continue our shelter in place one time, and it expires this weekend. And we wanted to demonstrate to the governor that we were ready with certain industries to move forward. The governor then later in the process came out with his own resiliency plan. They were very similar. There were some anomalies in the phases and whether the phases matched, et cetera. But the governor pretty much made it clear that you will be using our plan if you want to move forward. So there was a lot of work done on the START Guide. It was not all for naught. It still will be useful as we move forward with the different business segments and the different entities. And it's more of a local plan than the governor's. But we are defaulting to the governor's plan. And that's why this weekend on the 16th, when our shelter in place expires, we will not be implementing another shelter in place. So the nice thing about our plan was it gave us a little bit more flexibility than the governor's plan, and there was some room for interpretation in certain business sectors. And so it was a little bit more loose, I guess you would say, than the governor's plan. Now we are defaulting to the governor's plan. And we had a board meeting last Friday where the board had to attest to the fact that we're ready to move forward. Dr. Penny Bornstein had to attest to the fact that we're ready to move forward, and two of the hospitals, the CEOs of the hospitals, had to attest to the fact that we have capacity in our healthcare system in case we have a surge. So we submitted that to the governor's office, and there was one criteria that wasn't to the letter of the law met exactly. Our medical personnel do feel like we meet that criteria, and we and she attested to that. And it is between Dr. Penny Bornstein and Dr. Angel, who is the head of the State Department of Public Health. So I think they all kind of revolve around that one criteria, and that one criteria is in the governor's plan, you can't have more than one death per 10,000 individuals in your county in a 2-week period. And we have 280,000, one positive COVID positive. And we have about 280,000 people in this county. So it's sort of a dilemma for us, because we have a really real robust testing protocol here. We have two new sites set up in North County and South County to do testing. We're testing at our public health department. We've got all the urgent cares testing. Private physicians are testing. For example, if one individual in a family of five tests positive, we proactively, even if everybody else in that family is asymptomatic, we go in and test every single member of that family. And if you're living in close quarters, there's a pretty great chance that family members will test positive. So we're doing that, and other counties are not doing that. So I've always maintained that that sort of penalizes us by being proactive, and the governor wants all this testing done, but the more positives, then it hurts you to start and go forward. So I know there was an argument being made by Dr. Penny Bornstein that, you know, we shouldn't be penalized for that. And also the California Men's Colony, which we have absolutely no control over, but we are helping there with testing and things like that to be proactive, so we don't have spread of the virus. But that sort of works against us in our numbers too. Similarly to Santa Barbara County and the federal penitentiary down there, where they have no control. They have over 500 inmates that have tested positive. So even theoretically, if you had no other positives in all of Santa Barbara County, just the penitentiary would put them over that limit. What I've been told from Dr. Penny is they don't, the state does not want to drop that one criteria, but they realize the situation. I think they released 19 counties, mostly Northern California counties, yesterday. So we're sort of in limbo right now and waiting to reconcile this. And I'm not involved in those discussions. It's medical discussions with Dr. Bornstein and Dr. Angel. I think from what I'm being told, we should know in the next, you know, day or two where we're at. And if they give us the green light to move forward, it puts us into the latter stages of phase two of the governor's plan, which would allow the openings of restaurants with protocols and the opening of shopping in stores and like retail clothing stores, et cetera. So it does make a big difference to get to the end of stage two. And if we can, you know, meet the criteria and get there, that would allow that. In the meantime, businesses that are looking forward to welcoming customers back can go and look at the start guide and look at the different protocols and things to operate safely and get prepared for moving forward, because it could come any day right now.
That was SLO County Supervisor Lynn Compton speaking Thursday on the status of the county's reopening plan vis-a-vis the state's plan. KCBX News will have more on the latest reopening developments during All Things Considered starting at 4:30. A surfer was killed in a shark attack on May 9th in waters off State Beach near Watsonville. The type of shark that killed the surfer has now been identified. But as KAZU's Erica Mahoney reports, that's just one of the pieces of the puzzle in this rare attack.
As the local surfing community celebrates the life of 26-year-old Ben Kelly, scientists are piecing together what happened. California has a lab that's dedicated to investigating animal attacks.
So the Wildlife Forensics Laboratory, it's basically a crime lab.
Patrick Foy is a captain with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, one of the agencies involved in the investigation. Experts at their wildlife forensics lab helped determine it was a white shark, commonly referred to as a great white.
In terrestrial animals, we look at saliva, or we try to find the DNA in the saliva. Sharks don't really have saliva, but they have a mucus.
In investigating the attack that killed Kelly, scientists found microscopic traces of mucus in the victim's wetsuit and tooth fragments in the surfboard. Kelly was about 100 yards out from shore at Manresa State Beach, surfing with two friends, according to Gabe McKenna, a public safety superintendent with California State Parks.
It's my understanding that the surfer made it onto the shoreline, and the victim was later pronounced on the beach.
The Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Office determined the cause of death for Kelly was a bite to the right knee, hitting a major artery and vein. Patrick Foy again.
They tried to measure the distance between the teeth and the bites and a lot of different things that go into algorithm to try to identify the length or estimated length of this animal.
They determined the shark was between 10 and 12 feet.
I mean, fundamentally, this young, strong, healthy young man was killed by a shark. And for his family, that, you know, the size and length probably doesn't really matter.
But Foy says collecting the data helps scientists learn more about sharks and their behavior.
That's the important part of this.
The database of shark attacks in California begins in the 1950s. Dr. David Eber, a local shark expert, says attacks are rare.
On average, over that 70-year time period, there's been about three a year.
Ebert runs the Pacific Shark Research Center at Moss Landing Marine Laboratories and travels around the world studying sharks. He says white sharks begin eating marine mammals instead of fish when they are about the size of the shark that attacked Kelly. It's another piece of the puzzle, but there are still questions. Ebert says the timing of the attack is unusual. It happened around 1:30 in the afternoon.
Sharks tend to be most active like in the evening, during the night, and in the early morning.
And he says the time of year is unusual, too. White shark attacks generally occur from about July to November in California.
It's a wild animal, and so you just don't know why things happen at a certain time.
Over the years, Ebert says awareness of shark behavior has grown with technology like GoPros used by surfers and divers. And white sharks have always been part of the ecosystem of the Monterey Bay, including the beach where the attack occurred.
The surfers that are locals, they know the sharks are around there. If I've been up in the helicopter and we see some there, we'll usually call the lifeguards and tell them to let the surfers know that we're seeing sharks down there.
It's a known risk when you venture into the ocean here. But still, McKenna with California State Parks says this was an utterly tragic event.
I've never been a part of anything like this. I hope to never have this occur on our beaches again, but it is incredibly rare.
Surfing these waters was Ben Kelly's passion. He was a surfboard shaper and had his own business in Santa Cruz called Ben Kelly Surfboards. On his company website, he wrote, "I love the process of creating, taking something raw and formless and making it into something both functional and aesthetic." Kelly was married and had a close circle of friends, some of whom were by his side when he died. The outpouring of support on his social media shows how loved he is.
That was KAZU's Erica Mahoney reporting from Monterey County. Lighthouse Atascadero has been helping young people fight addiction since 1994. One of the founders, Don Clickard, talks about how Lighthouse started, how it has grown, and how the community has come together to help reach a common goal.
You're one of the founders of the Lighthouse program. How did you get the idea, and where did it start?
I think the start was the formation of the Atascadero Greyhound Athletic Foundation in 1994. We founded the foundation to create some really new and exciting athletic facilities at Atascadero High School, where I was the athletic director. And we built a 9-lane track and did all kinds of remodel of the stadium. So we've been obviously involved in our community since 1994. In 2011, we had a series of drug overdoses in our community of young men who had been our students and had been family members of our friends in the community. And one of the young men in particular was my godchild and the son of a very, very good friend who was one of the, there were four right in a row of drug overdoses or deaths related to the their use of drugs. The father of that young man I spoke of said, "Don, we have to do something." So there was a year while we looked around at what that something might be. When I came to Del Rio to talk to DJ Pittenger, the principal here, and she suggested that we bring back a county program called Sober School, 12 kids from Atascadero that were heroin addicts. And that was a surprising number, but we brought those kids back from that program here to a program at Del Rio that our Greyhound Foundation could help create and could fund. And since we already had a working board and interested people in the community, it was a ready-made program. Ralph Nelson actually said, when we said, "What are we going to call this thing?" He said, "Well, let's call it Lighthouse." basically, that first program was an intervention program to deal with those kids who were addicts. So the district hired part-time a drug abuse counselor, and which has subsequently evolved into a full-time licensed marriage and family therapist that we, the Greyhound Foundation, employs at Paloma Creek High School in partnership with the school district. The program of Lighthouse is a committee of the Atascadero Greyhound Foundation, but Lighthouse Atascadero has certainly taken on its own identity.
You have mentoring, you have counseling.
There are 8 Lighthouse programs. The main program is the intervention program at Paloma Creek High School. We fund a licensed marriage and family therapist, along with the school district. We also help fund the counselor, the academic counselor at Paloma Creek High School, and that's our continuation school. That's also in conjunction with the ACE Academy, it's Atascadero Choices in Education, and Atascadero High School. So our 3 secondary schools all benefit by the Lighthouse program. The other things that we do, we have high school kids who mentor 6th graders. This is the 3rd year of the mentoring program. We have a Lightkeepers Club, which is a service club composed of kids from 6th grade to age 22 who could be a part of the program either as mentees from 6th graders who are now 7th and 8th graders, the high school kids, and then as they graduate even from Paloma Creek. Normally, they have been involved with Lighthouse Coffee.
Do you sell the coffee? Does it help fund the programs, or is it more of a way for the kids to work and be involved in the community?
Well, Lighthouse Coffee came about as a result of a conversation with Joe Girardi, who's the owner of Joe Bella Coffee in Atascadero. He taught them how to choose their coffee, how to roast their coffee, how to create the blends that they wanted. And then they have their own label. And we also, because our community helped us, we purchased a van for them. And we've also just refurbished a trailer that is outfitted to go to different events where they take the trailer and they sell or give away coffee for donations. And the students run it. They develop their coffee products, as I've mentioned, and they actually man the trailer as it goes to different events. So they're learning a lot of things. They're learning the business part of it. They develop their own label. They're learning about dealing with the public, and they're learning about dealing with each other, learning about the different aspects of running a business. And it is a business that was designed not to make money, but it's turning out that it kind of is. And so there are things that they can do, activities that they can do as a result of the money they've earned from the coffee company.
Yeah, what a great opportunity for them to, you know, see what it's like from start to finish to run a business and how hard it can be.
Any of us that have been in retail of any kind in our lives, whether you're a newspaper carrier or running a restaurant, you know that dealing with the public has its challenges and opportunities. And as they graduate from school, they talk about their experiences with the Lighthouse Coffee as being kind of the highlight. I do want to mention, too, that the real important part of the Lighthouse is the Lighthouse Committee. There's 20 people on that committee, and they are people from our community. Some of them are former school administrators. Many of our business people in our community. Some are just people who are interested in adolescents and the problems of adolescents. And so our Lighthouse Committee, under the direction of Lloyd Bagby, we meet once a month during regular times. We plan out programs and create programs and have fundraisers. That's really important to us right now because we've lost those.
Because if they were fun runs, I think you had a 5K or golf tournaments. Do you have some other ideas for fundraisers?
Well, we do have a couple of things. We have modeled after your KCBX. We have a sustaining membership list. It's remained intact. We haven't lost anybody, and we have that income. We also have sponsorships, kind of our business sustainers, and we have those who contribute anywhere from $400 to $2,500 a year. Most of those, not all, but most of those have remained part of our program. We, of course, are not expecting to receive those sponsorships from, you know, our restaurants and some of the others that are really impacted by the pandemic.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. We're speaking with Don Clickard of Lighthouse Atascadero. How do the kids who are at risk, who are dealing with substance abuse, you know, in the high schools or even younger, how do they find you and how do you find them?
Of course, the term at risk is an interesting term because the young man who was kind of the reason for our beginning in the first place, the one I described earlier, was not what you would have described as an at-risk kid. He was a 4.0 student, an accomplished student athlete, was a scholarship athlete at Cal Poly. And this all happened certainly not as a result of those really good activities, but because of the how he got involved with the drug thing in the first place. So the at-risk kid is one that's difficult to describe because it could be anybody.
Right.
Probably everybody who listens to your program knows somebody who is involved in addiction, whether it's somebody from their family or a friend of the family. Almost everybody knows somebody who is an addict of some sort, whether it's alcoholism or drug abuse or eating disorders or whatever it might be. So the at-risk kid can be the ones that are sixth graders that are our mentees are identified by their teachers, not necessarily because they're at risk for drug use, but because maybe there's some family issues or some reason why they would need a mentor.
Mm-hmm.
So then I guess the answer to your question is our sixth grade teachers are the ones who are the fifth grade teachers actually are the ones who are identifying those kids from the beginning. The others, the ones at Paloma Creek who are in the intervention program, usually they come to Paloma Creek because they've those that are addictive will come to Paloma Creek because they've not succeeded elsewhere.
Yeah.
And that doesn't describe that whole population there because there's a lot of reasons why it could go to continuation. And most of the time it's not because of drug use. It's something else. It's maybe they're just not into rallies and football games and they just want to get their education and get on with it. So there's a lot of things going on with that as well.
During the pandemic, what kind of challenges have you been coming across?
Well, of course, the main thing is to the contact between the mentors who by this time have developed a good relationship with their mentees, the high school kids and their relationships with the sixth graders, and to maintain those. So the kids are good at that because they have Google Hangout. They know how to do this. They're hanging out, Google Hangout and Google Meeting, and it's been very effective.
So what else does Lighthouse Atascadero do with the kids?
We have a program called Lighthouse After School. That is a series. There are eight different programs from bicycle safety and bicycle repair to computer repair. There's art classes, there's cooking classes, there's gardening classes. There's eight classes altogether that involve elementary kids from the third grade through the fifth grade. And so we've obviously not been able to do that since February.
Those sound like great programs, interesting things.
They are.
And
the people who teach them, they've been trained to not just be teaching computers or the other things that I described, but they're being trained in being mentors so that when somebody grows up, they want to be like Keith Schmidt, the bicycle guy, because he's the great guy. He's the mentor in the bicycle program, and he runs Cayman Cycle, and he's really good. And he's just, anybody who knows Keith, and most people here do in Atascadero, he's just a great man. So that when he has those classes that he rotates through all of the elementary schools, he's mentoring kids to want to be like Keith Schmidt when they grow up. That's what that's about. We're also in the process right now of writing a book, The Story of Lighthouse. Carol Gobler is the author, and she is writing this book, which will describe the experiences of parents who've lost children, parents whose children have come out the other side and been healthy. She's talked to kids and she's talked to people who have some connection to this drug abuse program. It's an awareness piece for us, but it's also, we think it's a prevention piece. It's really important for all communities to know that there is a way to combat this. Our drug use and our overdose rate, our arrest rate in terms of drugs has been reduced in our community, according to police and fire, by the program of Lighthouse. But we really want to expand this to other communities in certainly in our county to start with.
Well, it sounds valuable, and it sounds like you've been successful. What inspires you?
I'll tell you one story. If you recall, I mentioned the original 12 kids, young men that we brought over from the county to Del Rio to be our first Lighthouse clients, I guess you'll call them.
Mm-hmm.
Those 12, and here's a number that people who know about addiction will be amazed at. Those 12, that was 2012 when we brought them over here. They are still all clean and sober, or they were as of about a year ago. They were all still clean and sober, which is an amazing number because recidivism in drug addiction or addiction of any kind is normally really high.
Wow.
But the one young man who is kind of our poster child, one of the activities that we did was rock climbing. And when this young man graduated from high school, he started his own rock climbing company. And he sent us an email, and this has been about a year ago now, but the email was describing his company and his successes with what he was doing. But the last line of his email said, And you know, you guys, without Lighthouse, I'm a dead kid. I'm sorry, that one chokes me up every time I say it. When you hear the graduation speeches from the kids at Plymouth Creek High School, and as they graduate when they finish. So we'll have graduations, I have two today, in fact, that they'll do. They do a slide presentation and they do their graduate profile. And in their graduate profile, they always talk about their experiences at Plymouth Creek with their wonderful teachers and the programs there. But almost invariably, they'll mention Lighthouse as being a really important part of their success there. So when we hear those, and when we know those kids, because maybe they've been selling coffee or whatever they've been doing, we know them and we can see their successes, which isn't entirely because of Lighthouse. It's a lot to do with their families, their support groups. But Lighthouse has been an important part of what they were doing. And when you see that, and then those kids come back and they work in the service club or do something after they graduate from Plum Creek, that keeps you going for sure. Knowing that that we're all involved, I say we because our little slogan is we, not me, because it's not a me thing, it is a we thing. And we do it together, and our community is certainly part of that we. Those sustaining members, those business sponsors, they're all part of we. I think that the important thing is that we all understand, we being all of us in our community, understand that addiction is a very, very serious thing for those who are afflicted with it. And some people would say, you know, I did this, but I quit smoking cigarettes, so I can do anything. Well, you know, sometimes you can't quit. Sometimes you need help to quit. It isn't something that just you can do because you're strong. It is something that you have to work at really hard if you have an addiction. And so if people understand anything, people who themselves aren't victims of that, understand that it is not easy to stop once that Mr. Drug gets a hold of you, because it's a we thing. It's all of us together. Thanks for the opportunity.
Remind us again of the website.
LighthouseAtascadero.org.
We've been speaking with Don Clickard of Lighthouse Atascadero. Wild yeast. It's all around us. And today, Father Ian takes us along as he gets a closer look.
This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food.
So where are we now?
So right now we are at the Inspiration Point Trailhead, which is part of the Romero Trail system at the entry to the Los Padres National Forest. It's right at the end of Tunnel Road, which is at the end of Mission Canyon Road.
Yeast, it's all around us. During this pandemic, home bakers are having trouble finding yeast in the stores. One of the perks of living on the Central Coast is that we have unfettered access to unprocessed fresh produce. So why not use fresh, unprocessed yeast? It's easy. You just put a jar of flour, water, and sugar outside with cheesecloth over the top, and voila, you've captured some yeast. Okay, so it's not quite that easy. Two popular uses of yeast are for beer making and bread making. Playing with Food went on a hunt for local wild yeast and has produced a segment on each of those uses, a 5-month, 1,800-mile journey with my now good buddy Chip Nasser from Night Lizard Brewing Company in Santa Barbara. This one is about making bread with wild yeast, specifically wild yeast captured near Poison Oak, which is how this segment got its name. And here's how we did it.
What we're actually doing is trying to capture the yeast that comes off the fruit and just floats around in the air.
Yep, or sometimes it's attached to bees. Bees are like one of the number one transporters of yeast.
Like they say with sourdough bread, if you want to start your own sourdough starter that is from your own environment rather than getting it from somebody else who's had it from all over the world, you kind of do the same thing. You take a bowl of water and flour and put cheesecloth over it and put it outside, right?
Exactly. Yeah, we're doing the exact same thing, and we have basically liquidized flour in our jars. That's what wort is, because we've taken all of the sugar out of mashed up grain. We basically just have liquid flour and sugar in water, and that's it.
You said 24 hours.
24 hours. Yep, I'll be back tomorrow morning to pick all these jars up.
Good?
Yeah, I bet. I'm like surrounded by poison oak fruit.
Sorry about that.
No.
Oh, I'm right next to it as well.
Yeah, it's tricky this time of year.
Yeah. Yeah.
One more.
I almost walked right into it. I didn't, though, I don't think.
It's
Well, there's so many like leaves of it on the ground too.
What kind of yeast does poison oak give you?
We've never sampled the poison oak areas. This will be the most poison oak areas we've ever sampled, but it'd be interesting in the spring to do it because they do flower like crazy. So we know what avocados give you. Avocados give you some pretty funky Saison style yeast. Not too fruity or anything like that, just a real Belgian-y, but we've done a lot of avocado orchards. I just want this oak tree. Yeah, I'm like kind of modifying my sampling a little bit based on the poison oak. Like I would.
Right next to your right elbow.
Yeah, poison oak here and poison oak there. Well, this will be the poison oak sample. We'll do it. That's right in the poison oak jungle. That's it. That's the entire putting out of the sample process. You know, it doesn't take long at all.
So we're hiking out.
We're hiking out. Yeah, luckily it's all downhill on the way out.
During my second or third visit to the brewery to check on the yeast and its propagation before using it to make beer, the subject of using wild yeast for bread came up again.
Yeast is used to make beer, but yeast is also used to make bread. Is it possible to take any of that yeast and make bread?
Most definitely. You can even use bread to make beer. There's old Ethiopian styles of beer that were just old loaves and kind of the butt of the loaf thrown into water, and just the yeast that was naturally in that bread helped facilitate some fermentation, and it made not by any means a high alcohol brew, but it made a little bit of a brew, and that bread beer was one of the first beers in the world. Yeah, it's been around for the ages. They're almost interchangeable, I would say, bread and beer.
So my question in terms of can you make bread out of it now, should we do a side-by-side experiment?
Like with sourdough or something?
Yeah, can you send me home with some of that and you make beer and I make bread and we try the bread and the beer at the same time?
Yeah. I would say for safety, maybe a sample out of the next round of it, the 3-liter culture, just to make sure that nothing funky or anything like that that's growing in there, even for the bread side of things, because you don't want anything funky growing in your bread loaf.
That'd be interesting. Yeah. We die from eating bread. Even though it's on its way to being made into beer, the yeast can still be harvested in order to make bread.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. Okay. And I'll decant all of the liquid off of the top, so I just have this powdery slurry left at the bottom before I pitch it in, and that's what I would fill you up like a little 50 mil conical of just that powder.
Okay.
And then you put that right into your dough and let it leaven and everything like that, and that would be the pure yeast. That way you're getting a little bit of like sugar and malt sugar and stuff like that, so it's not really great. I mean, it could make a nice, you know, rye loaf or something like that. But if you're making sourdough or something like that, I don't think you want all the random sugars and stuff that are in there.
Okay, so we'll do that.
Yeah.
And then when your beer is ready, like the day before I'm coming down to taste the beer,
yeah,
I'll make a loaf of bread.
That'd be awesome.
How long will the yeast last if I put it in the fridge?
Months.
Okay,
months.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
3 months or so.
Right, right.
I have a strain that is cultured and refrigerated in here that is also a wild yeast from our first round of it. I could give you that right now.
That I can practice. That.
Yeah.
Okay. I can do that. I can practice.
Cool.
Oh, you're just going to give that to me.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have plenty of it just in case you need more?
Yeah, that's actually our yeast strain that we sent to Imperial Organics, and they ran the whole strain through PCR tests and DNA analysis. They found that we have like a novel strain that we captured out here in the Santa Barbara Hills. So
that's great.
They grew it up for us, propagated it, and now we're going to buy a pitch from them that has been all cleaned in the lab and everything like that. I mean, I'm doing kind of, you know, backwoods bootleg biology here. I'm sanitary and stuff like that, and I have the laboratory or the good manufacturing processes from my time at Amgen in biotech, but I don't have nearly the labs that they have up there. Just kind of taking it to the next level. Once we knew we had something that was good and made a good beer, we wanted to make it even better. So they really cleaned it up for us quite a bit.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio, and you're listening to Playing with Food on Issues and Ideas with me, Father Ian. I used Night Lizard's first yeast to test my bread-making skills and to be ready to make bread with the poison oak yeast when it was ready. My bread turned out flat and funky. I took it to Chip anyway, who tasted it and described it like this.
I liked it, though. The flavor was there, for sure. Yeah, it definitely was flavorful, and there wasn't any, like, crazy grains in there or anything like that. It was just
It was a regular commercial bread flour, and then there was a quarter of it was whole wheat flour that was grown locally.
Oh, okay.
I haven't had any issues with it before. And it was really wet. So I don't know if that might...
Like the dough was really wet?
The dough was really wet.
Okay.
I'm not a master bread maker.
Yeah, well, it's good.
But you're a master brewer, so...
I don't know if I have that title yet. I don't know. Yeah, I'm...
We tasted the bread. What are you going to do with the bread? I'm going to leave the bread with you.
Yeah.
You can put butter on it. You can make your toast. You can use it as a doorstop. Or...
So our current plan, I think, for it is to crumble it up and do a little 3-gallon beer with it. Actually put some yeast on top of the bread, crumble it up, a little bit of water, and see if we can make like an old world style beer. See how it works and probably be ready about the same time you come back. So we can bring you some of that too.
But you'll have to add yeast? You can't just do it from...
Yeah, okay. Just because you baked it, all the yeast is killed. So we'll just add another little slug of our wild yeast that we propped off of right there and... see how it does. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
So the yeast became bread, and the bread became the grain, so to speak, for beer. The yeast that Chip and I hunted down did turn out to be viable.
And this is our, this is your poison oak yeast, right?
It is, yeah. The yeast from the poison oak bush. It was one I was least excited about going and retrieving, but of course, the irony that it's... thing I'm most allergic to, too, I think on the planet is poison oak, and it's got the best yeast, and I was sure those tuberosa bushes would be the spot with all of the flower and bee activity. The more I'm thinking about it, if I might not be able to give you, I just want to have like enough yeast to make sure the beer ferments all the way. I might not have enough to give you bread yeast.
That's the most important, is that you're able to do your job.
Beer. Yeah, yeah. Well, let's just do that then. So okay. we'll make the beer, and then I'll even get you some more yeast off of the beer that we make for the bread making.
Okay.
And then we can try it again. I'll get you a big volume, like a big jar of it this time, so you don't have to worry about propping up your own yeast or anything like that.
So it was time to finally make a nice loaf of bread with the locally sourced wild yeast, a test loaf, and then the real thing.
The yeast I've taken out of the can. It smells very beer-like. And it's got a sweet tone to it. Yeah, it smells like sweet beer. Here I am in my kitchen attempting to make bread with this yeast that we found next to the poison oak plant. I'm using my regular recipe, and I opened the can of yeast that Chip gave me, and there was a lot of effervescence. So I'm going to take a chance here. I'm going to use 1.5 cups of the yeast liquid directly into my recipe, and then the remaining cup, I'm going to see if yeast settles out to the bottom and decant off the liquid. And I'm doing that because it was so effervescent that there is some growth there. I genuinely don't know what I'm doing, so we'll just see how it goes. So I'm going to use my yeast as my water and yeast already, so I'm not going to add any more liquid. I'm going to use some sugar to keep that yeast going, flour, salt, and oil. And then I've rigged up something at church where I can keep it warm. In the kitchen at church, we have a flat top. The pilot light on the flat top keeps it warm. And so I'm going to put my bowl on top of a plate in order to keep it directly off of the flat top. And then I'm going to put a mixing bowl, a large mixing bowl, over my bowl of bread dough so it has this warm environment in which to raise, taking hours or days or weeks, however long, and we'll see how that works. I now have a smooth, soft ball of dough, and I'm going to put it in a bowl, and then I'm going to put it in my controlled heat environment on the flat top in the church kitchen. I'm here in the St. Stephen's kitchen, and I'm about ready to lift up the lid on my second rise of the bread. Oh, okay, it's flat like I thought it was going to be, but it has risen. It seems to me that the environment was too warm, but Chip said the yeast needs a warm environment, so I did what he told me to do. It smells lovely, like freshly baked bread, and my bread is about ready to come out of the oven. There's kind of this sharp smell to it that I'm not quite sure what it is. It might be the poison oak. When we taste it, we'll find out. I've got my bread at home now. It's much fluffier than the bread that I made last time with the other strand of yeast. It's not really raised really high. It actually has a nice crust on it. It's a lovely, lovely taste of bread. This was pure white, unbleached bread flour, olive oil, salt, and yeast. And so the flavor that's coming through is definitely from the yeast. It tastes like bread made from beer. It's really nice.
I'm going to have it with my soup.
So I'm going to make two different loaves of bread here. I took the undecanted yeast straight from the can that Chip gave me and created a sourdough starter, and I'm going to use that to make one loaf of bread. And then I'm going to use the decanted yeast, which is going to be more concentrated, and use about a tablespoon of that to make a different loaf of bread and see how they differ. Because this yeast seems to be very active, the Biga doubled and quadrupled in size overnight in my cold kitchen, I'm going to slow ferment this dough and put it in the refrigerator. Both doughs have turned out really, really well, and I'm really happy. Both turned out really well. I did a slow proofing in the refrigerator. They kind of had to come in and out back and forth in order to get them at the same point at the same time. And it's been not quite 48 hours, about 40 hours. And I'm going to punch them down and I'm going to knead them again, shape one of them into two loaves, shape another one into a boule, and put them in the fridge for another slow rise before I bake them right before I go down to see Chip. I've woken up on the day that I'm going to go down and take this bread to Chip, and the bread has overproofed a little bit, but I'm going to put it in the oven and bake it just as it is. We're going to put it in the oven at a really high temperature to begin with for 10 minutes and then bring that temperature down to bake it fully.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio, and we are playing with poison oak on Issues and Ideas with me, Father Ian. And the results? Back to Santa Barbara for the 7th time to taste my bread and beer made from my previous bread, all stemming from the yeast that Chip and I captured 5 months earlier among a bunch of poison oak.
So here we are in front of our poison oak bread and beer, the yeast we found by the poison oak. It's been a long process. We started in September and it's now January. I've taken the yeast that you gave me and made 3 different loaves of bread. But tell me about the beer first.
The beer was really, really easy. We used that loaf that you brought in last time that was pretty much like a rock. We froze it first to make sure there was nothing living inside of the loaf itself, killed everything out, really deep froze it, crumbled it up into a powder, and then I boiled it just like you would use a mash, not super, super hot. Fermented it with our poison oak yeast, just as I would make a normal beer. It was a lot chunkier and more viscous than normal beer was, but it just fermented out just like any other beer would. It does taste a lot like more of a like an Abbey Belgian fruit forward type style to me, and that's why I was saying it's pretty unique. Aren't many beers that taste like this, that's for sure.
And what do you attribute that to?
I'd say it's a combination of doing something really, really weird and then using a yeast that nobody has made something that's super unique.
This is what I did. You gave me a can full of yeast and liquid. So this one here, this half loaf that's not very tall, is made straight from the can. It did some funky things. I had to do this MacGyver thing with the stove top at church. Yep. And it took 2 days for the first proof, like 110 degrees. And then I did another 36 to 40 hours.
Then you're saying you pretty much just used the liquid at the top out of that one for this one?
Yeah.
Okay. And that's most likely where the most active beer yeast is in that liquid layer, actually. And the solid parts are where the yeast is starting to die and kind of fall out of solution.
Oh.
So that's interesting. I'm wondering if the fact that the yeast was dying or getting itself ready for hibernation and you use that yeast, if you kind of molded our wild yeast to be a bread maker by then starting that off, as opposed to me having it more set to be a beer maker in that liquid slurry.
Right.
So, and you said it really dissolved ate up it almost to like a sourdough liquid. So I'm wondering, that obviously had no problem eating up those starches and sugars. So that's interesting.
This one is sort of like a sourdough starter. I took a little bit of the yeast
from the original splash.
Uh-huh. And I put it with some flour and some sugar, let it sit overnight. It was very, very super active.
Oh, cool.
And then I took all of that and put it into my bread recipe with a bit of extra liquid.
Nice.
And then this round loaf is fully decanted yeast. Took a tablespoon of it.
Oh, wow.
Yep. Just a tablespoon.
Yeah.
And made that.
Wow.
And these two, I did a day and a half each for them to rise. So which should we try first, the beer or the bread?
Let's do the beer first.
Okay, this is the beer first. Yeah, it's heavy.
It is.
It's a winter beer.
Definitely. Yeah. Dark in color. A lot of like date, raisin, Belgian-y fruit flavor.
It's not bad.
No. No, it's not necessarily something I would go to and say, give me a bottle of this.
How many people have tried it?
Just you, me, and Clay so far. That's okay. It, yeah.
So should we try the bread?
Mm-hmm.
So this is the one made from just the decanted.
Just right out of the yeast slurry, straight into a
bread. Right out of the yeast slurry, yep. Here you go. Try that.
It tastes a lot to me like a squaw bread or like a bread made with whole grain flour, like a darker, like almost pumpernickel-y.
Yeah.
Bread. Yeah.
Or maybe even have like molasses in it or something like that. And it doesn't. It's white bread flour, basic white loaf recipe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's really dark in color for that, for being...
This is the one that was sort of like sourdough starter.
They look like bread. This one especially, it has more of the air pockets in it than that other one.
Yeah, it has air.
Yep. Oh, wow. That one has way more bread texture. Like it feels like bread on my mouth. Yeah.
Hey, Clay, do you want to try any of the bread?
Which bread are you having here? This one?
Yep. Well, there's a couple different ones, yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
All made with our yeast.
Serious?
Yeah.
It's all poison oak yeast. There we go.
And all the same recipe, basically, for the base ingredients for the bread.
That's really good.
Yeah. Oh, Dad, try that other one compared to that one as far as they're the same yeast, same recipe, even just different baking technique.
Same grain?
For even. Yeah.
Yep.
But they're, like, way different. Wow, that looks really good. Yeah, I'd buy that one,
too. I'd buy this.
Here is the one that was made with fully decanted yeast.
And that's crazy that it was just a tablespoon of the original slurry caused this much.
Not the original slurry, the decanted slurry.
Decanted slurry, so of your sourdough culture. Oh, wow. That's really good.
It is
good.
It tastes like a real loaf of bread.
Yeah, that's really, really good. Man. Hey, Claire, are you back there? You gotta try this bread.
It was a very unique journey with very unique results. Using wild yeast from a poison oak bush to make bread is something that never, ever popped into my mind before I met Chip. It just goes to show that the Central Coast really is an amazing place for food. And for that, we should all be very thankful. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
Been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. It's at kcbx.org.